And our sermon text today is Song of Solomon, chapter 8, verses 5 through 14. Who is that coming up from the wilderness, leaning on her beloved? Under the apple tree, I awakened you. There your mother was in labor with you. There she who bore you was in labor. Set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm. For love is strong as death. Jealousy is fierce as the grave. Its flashes are flashes of fire, the very flame of the Lord. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can floods drown it. If a man offered for love all the wealth of his house, he would be utterly despised. We have a little sister, and she has no breasts. What shall we do for our sister on the day when she is spoken for? If she is a wall, we will build on her a battlement of silver. But if she is a door, we will enclose her with boards of cedar. I was a wall, and my breasts were like towers. Then I was, in his eyes, as one who finds peace. Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Hamon. He let out the vineyard to keepers. Each one was to bring for its fruit 1,000 pieces of silver. My vineyard, my very own, is before me. You, O Solomon, may have 1,000, and the keepers of the fruit of 200. O you who dwell in the gardens, with companions listening for your voice, let me hear it. Make haste, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountains of spices. Who personifies wisdom for women these days? Kate Millett is one who in our culture personifies wisdom for many. Kate Millett was one of the founders of the National Organization for Women back in the 60s. And she was the author of the very influential book, Sexual Politics. That was a book that aimed at destroying the patriarchy of the traditional nuclear family. Kate Millett was also an ardent Marxist. And when she made the cover of Time magazine in August of 1970, Time dubbed her as the Mao Zedong of the women's movement. So it's no coincidence either that the destruction of the family is also one of the 10 goals of the Communist Manifesto. Kate Millett identified herself as bisexual. And at Maoist-style rallies, she and her lesbian comrades would chant things like, "How can we destroy monogamy?" And the answer would come back, "By promoting promiscuity, eroticism, prostitution, and homosexuality." That's all according to her sister, Mallory, who was initially caught up in the first excitement of that movement, but she eventually became disenchanted with it, disillusioned with her sister's evil, she calls it, and she returned to the Christian faith of her childhood. Mallory. But not Kate. In fact, her life descended quickly into what her sister called, and I quote, "a mix of Marxism, atheism, paganism, witchcraft, the occult, and a flat-out psychotic, if not demonic, element as well," unquote. Now, there's a brief sketch of this darker side of one of the founders of modern feminism in Paul Kengor's book. I recommend this book to you. Paul Kengor, last year, published a book, "The Devil and Karl Marx." Isn't that an intriguing title? "The Devil and Karl Marx." And the subtitle is "Communism's Long March of Death, Deception, and Infiltration." Well, Kate Millett's book is still required reading in many women's studies departments of major universities across the country. And she remains a role model for the modern feminist. Now, in closing our series on the Song of Solomon, I ask the women of New Geneva, where might we find wisdom for women in the Bible? And I hope that by now we would answer not in the women's studies departments of the world, but in the example of our young shepherd girl, nicknamed Shulamith, of the Song of Solomon, a role model. Today, we treat the epilogue. The epilogue, in fact, gives us the distilled wisdom, very valuable chapter, without which Song of Solomon would not be as efficacious. But the epilogue, in fact, gives us that distilled wisdom of her experience for all young women, intended for all young women as a guide for their lives. So let's look to that today, that distilled wisdom. We just finished reading the epilogue. 3 points I want to make with you from it. And the inside flap of your bulletin, you'll have a brief outline there of those points. And verses 5 through 7, first of all, point number 1, verses 5 through 7, the epilogue, Shulamith's Solomonic wisdom is distilled in the principles that biblical love is rock solid, white hot, endures all trials, and cannot be bought. Verses 5 through 7. Now, the setting for the epilogue is familiar to us by now, for those of you that have been with us through the series. The setting for the epilogue. Coming up from the wilderness, you see in your text, which is the traditional place of testing, the wilderness, right? Moses was tested in the wilderness. Israel was tested in, our Lord was tested in the wilderness. Shulamith, too, has been tested these three times by Solomon and his seductive rock and roll songs. And we've characterized them, for lack of a better metaphor, as rock and roll songs, right? These three beautiful, seductive songs that he sings to the harem girls as they enter in for probation, right, for their time of testing. She has resisted those. And implied here, Shulamith is leaning on who? Shulamith is leaning on an unidentified erotic partner, as some characterize it. Or maybe Solomon. Maybe the church is leaning on Christ as an allegory. No. We've seen that she's leaning on our shepherd boy, her simple shepherd boy. That's been our context, right? There's been three characters here at work. There's been Shulamith and Solomon and the shepherd boy. A key verb is here, awakened. Ya'ur in Hebrew. Awakened. Shulamith's adjuration solemnly warns the harem girls. You remember the adjuration, which divides Song of Solomon into three different parts. I adjure you, that is, I call you, I swear you to an oath. I adjure you. Daughters of Jerusalem, that is the harem, that you not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. Under the apple tree, I awakened you. You see our text says today in verse 5, right? Under the apple tree, I awakened you. Love is now awakened. She has passed those three tests, those three trials, those three temptations. And now love is ready to be awakened. Not awakened in the harem, which we saw is a sinful destruction of biblical marriage, but rather now in marriage as she prepares for marriage. Love has been awakened. The epilogue specifically amplifies that indeed love is now pleased to be awakened. Finally, she's been warning the harem girls all this time, but now love is finally ready and pleased to be awakened. And I hope you see that how crucial a turning point in the narrative this is, which only the shepherd boy framework can redeem from incoherence here too. And then we have a third crucial element, that is the mother. There are seven references throughout the Song of Solomon to the mother, right? And we've learned by now, as we have absorbed and understood and unpacked what the mother represents and means in this Song of Solomon, she is the stark, fertile, luminous contrast to the sterile womb of the harem. Children were a nuisance in the harem. In fact, they were often submitted for sacrifice to Baal later in the kingdom's history. Remember, the mother made her first appearance back in chapter 3. Scarcely had I passed them, that is the watchman of the city, Shulamith does, when I found him whom my soul loves. That is the beloved in her dream, right? In her dream state. She finds him. I held him and would not let him go until I had brought him into my mother's house and into the chamber of her who conceived me. We've seen that the mother and the home has been that place of nurture and safety and protection, especially from the predations of Solomon and the harem. And it's been consistent in all seven mentions of Shulamith's mother, as it is here too. We have another explicit reference here to the fruitfulness of covenant love. Yeah, there's a double entendre there with the idea of the mother and the chamber of her who conceived me. Not only the inner room of protection and safety, but also the womb. Fruitfulness of the womb as well. And here in our text today, we have another explicit reference to the fruitfulness of covenant love versus the sterile sexuality of Solomon's harem. There your mother was in labor with you. There she who bore you was in labor. Now this is Hebrew poetry too, so keep this in mind. We're not having didactic teaching laid out here for you. This is Hebrew poetry and it's meant to be received as poetry and understood as poetry. The mother in the womb is the place, continues to be in our text right to the last, that place of refuge and safety and nurture. It is fertile and productive versus the sterility and futility of harem life. There was also a double entendre in that Shulamith has been in labor too. She has been in labor, giving birth to the complete, fully tested, in probation, woman of covenant love. She has been in labor, giving birth to that. The complete, fully tested in probation, right? The woman of covenant love versus the daughters of Jerusalem, that is the harem girls. And so, the setting is that of Shulamith's arrival versus Solomon's arrival. Remember when Solomon arrived in great pomp and circumstance? Here comes the Elvis of Israel, right? With his rock and roll culture in tow. What a contrast this is to Solomon's arrival. Instead of empty flattery that Solomon puts before her, Shulamith offers true, concise wisdom concerning covenantal love. Concerning covenantal love. Set me as a seal upon your heart, it begins. As a seal upon your arm. And in this concise wisdom condensed for us here in verses 6 and 7, that's primarily what we're looking at here, is a distillation of her wisdom experienced throughout her time of probation, her time of temptation. She comes now to her beloved, to her shepherd boy. Set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm. In this, Shulamith implores the shepherd boy to publicly acknowledge her as his covenant love. Shulamith implores here the shepherd boy, set me as a seal, to publicly acknowledge her as his covenant love. That's the significance of the seal. As the dictionary of the Old Testament puts it, it says sealing was a means of closing something from interference, the visible and public application of authority. That's what we've been looking for. Those are some of the important markers of true covenant love. It's objective, it's communal, it's familial, right? All those things must be present to reap the fruits of covenant love, that is sex and intimacy and pleasure. So this is a poetic reference to marriage, if you will. The counterpart throughout the song to the fruits of marriage, which harem life rots. Harem life robs all of that. It skims on the surface sex and intimacy and pleasure and leaves all of the responsibility behind. But now for Shulamith, now is the time for the public familial community act of sealing one another emotionally, that's the idea of the heart, and physically, that's the idea of the arm. Seal me on your heart, seal me on your arm. Emotionally and physically. The shepherd boy has already been embraced by the family, that is the mother, right, the figure of the mother, standing for the entire family of Shulamith. And now the two will be witnessed and sealed and belong to one another. They will belong to one another. Paul describes it in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. He says, for the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. There's that mutuality between husband and wife that's present here as well. And then we see the ground for sealing is the rock-solid nature of love. Set me as a seal upon... For love is as strong as death. Jealousy is fierce as the grave. That's not intended to be a morbid metaphor. Miles Van Pelt, who I've drawn a lot of insight on this text from, he has quipped that this passage, chapter 8, verses 6 and 7, tells us that love is rock solid, white hot, and endures many trials. That's a nice thumbnail summary of verses 6 and 7. This is the rock solid part. And it concisely sums up what Shulamith says when she says, for love is as strong as death, jealousy as fierce as the grave. Death is pretty strong, isn't it? Who gets out of here alive? Since the fall, who can alter the ineluctable onset of death? It is strong, but so is love. The beast of death fiercely consumes all of life in its path, but the idea of jealousy here, and the idea of jealousy is not the green-eyed monster kind of jealousy, but rather the idea of the mutual protection and guardianship of love in marriage. There is that positive sense to jealousy where you mutually protect one another, you mutually guard one another, right, in love. That is equally fierce against all intruders and interlopers, that is, men like Solomon. Love is this rock solid, okay? But then we also see that love is also white hot. That's the upshot of 6b. Its flashes are flashes of fire, the very flame of the Lord. This is true biblical covenantal love. God gives true, genuine sexual intimacy. Dr. Van Pelt puts it this way. He says, the type of heat described here is the heat of physical intimacy created for the marriage relationship. Not for the harem, right? Not for rock and roll culture out there, okay? Madonna didn't originate sexual heat, okay? Van Pelt goes on to say, rock-solid commitment makes white-hot intimacy possible. And white-hot intimacy fuels, protects, and supports rock-solid commitment. They're mutually supportive. They're mutually sustaining. Van Pelt puts it this way. He says, the wisdom of the song, teaches that both commitment and intimacy work together to secure, strengthen, and protect the marriage relationship. This is what the Song of Solomon is about. But she also tells us, this is Shulamith, our wise woman, love also endures hardship. Many waters cannot extinguish love. And rivers cannot flood it. Another great metaphor, a poetic metaphor. We're dealing with poetry here that nevertheless describes very eloquently real states of life. Many waters cannot extinguish love and rivers cannot flood it. Our wise woman has just endured the flood of free rock and roll love songs and temptations and flatteries of Solomon, hasn't she? she has passed her probation. Now we've seen that irony again, that double entendre, poetry again we're dealing with, the idea of probation. When a young virgin girl went into harem life, as we see in the book of Esther, she was there on probation for a year while they examined her, watched her, see if she's fit to be with a king, right? And they groom her, prepare her for a year. She's in a time of probation. Well, the irony is, she's also, Shulamith now is in a time of probation before the Lord. Will she succumb to the temptations of the harem life? Or will she resist and opt for biblical covenantal love? Most of the harem girls succumb to the blandishments of Sodom. Not so Shulamith. She is truly wise. She is, as my wife says, she's the one who got away. And Solomon writes the Song of Solomon to her. And then as well, love cannot be bought. Number 5, we see that love cannot be bought. If a man offered for love all the wealth of his house, he would be utterly despised. Love cannot be bought. Silver threads and golden needles, right? Cannot mend this heart of mine. Now, in a day and time, we were looking at the days and times of ancient Israel. In a day and time when life was often a hand-to-mouth existence, we've seen, and we've looked at this time and time again, we've seen that the promise of harem life was one way out of poverty for a young beauty on the farm. Not only was there the promise of at least one night with the Elvis of Israel, Solomon, but there would be thereafter a life of ease and luxury in the harem. She would have it made. So what if you had to give up covenant love and home and community? So what, right? Many a beauty in Israel gave that up for harem life. Not so Shulamith. Biblical covenant love cannot be bought. And she's committed to it. So from Shulamith, we have a succinct distillation of wisdom regarding true biblical covenant love. That's a credit to her name. Remember, we saw that her name has the same consonants as the name of Solomon. But we pronounce it, we feminize it in the vowel pronunciation of Shulamith, but the same consonants as Solomon. So there's a play on words, a deliberate double entendre, even in her nickname, Shulamith. Solomon, the wisest of all men, is a fool in the Song of Solomon. He's a Nabal. In all wisdom literature, there is a contrast between the fool and the wise, between the Chochmah and the Nabal. Otherwise, you don't really have wisdom literature. And the idea of the shepherd boy in tension with Solomon and the shepherd girl provides us with that tension between the fool, ironically being Solomon, and the wise, ironically being Shulamith. Okay? This wisdom of Shulamith, this wisdom should be characteristic of Solomon. But who in the song is busy about his pursuit of pleasure? That's summarized in Ecclesiastes. There in Ecclesiastes, Solomon reflects. He says, I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. He's doing that here. But behold, this also was vanity, he says. Vanity indeed. In fact, it will lead to idolatry. Once again, as we've seen, these two are mutually sustained. Idolatry leads to sexual immorality. Just as certainly as the practice of sexual immorality leads to idolatry. But by practicing biblical covenant love that is rock solid and white hot, you seal that loop that keeps you protected from that slippery slope down which Solomon fell. When he first began to cultivate not a biblical vineyard. We've seen that's a metaphor for a woman's heart and soul and body to the idea of a biblical vineyard, but rather Solomon cultivates a pagan one in establishing his harem. But we yet hear voices from the harem, too. In our text today, we hear voices from the harem. Remember, we have seen there's been a division, a split in the harem. Well, that brings us to verses 8 through 12. Point 2. Verses 8 through 12. Shulamith's Solomonic wisdom finds true peace and contentment in the love of the shepherd boy rather than the luxury of Solomon's harem. Verses 8 through 12. We have a little sister and she has no breasts. What shall we do for our sister on the day when she is spoken for? Right? That's how this section begins. Now, we've already observed that Shulamith's wise resistance to the songs of Solomon, there's a double entendre here, even in the title. The Song of Solomon is the larger work in which we find true biblical wisdom, but then as a subset, there are those three songs of Solomon by which he tries to seduce these young virgins, including Shulamith. And she has resisted those songs of Solomon that he has created, that he has made. And in doing so, in resisting as a witness before the harem, she has created a rift in the harem itself. We've seen that. The dance between two armies is that poetic reference to that rift. There are now two armies, two sides, if you will, two parties in the harem itself. Those within the harem who see the implicit wisdom of Shulamith ask on behalf of those who will enter the same temptations and probation as Shulamith has just endured. That is our sister spoken for here. They now see the course they should take. That is to strengthen and encourage these women, these girls, in the course which Shulamith has taken. Once again, Hebrew poetry we're dealing with here. There's a double entendre at work in the metaphor of wall and door, too. A wall and a door not only speaks of the youthful state of a girl, but also of protection and safety. A wall and a door also offer protection and safety. Once again, that's been a theme in the Song of Solomon. Those who have learned from Shulamith, though it be too late for them, will strengthen and encourage their sisters in resisting the temptations of the rock and roll life of the Elvis of Israel and the lifestyle he offers. We've already seen the wall as separating outsiders from the predations on the harem of Solomon at the palace. Remember when the wall kept out the shepherd boy from seeing Shulamith? There was a wall separating, protecting from the predations on the harem of Solomon. Every harem had one, you know. But now that metaphor is cleverly reversed in that a figurative wall will separate the sister from the predations of Solomon. Now, and the sisters, those in the harem who understand her wisdom, they will now enhance and encourage that resistance. Battlements of silver, they will construct. That is, we will add to her protection and we will add to her nurture. We will enclose her with boards of cedar. The sisters who come forward to join the harem, we will now protect and dissuade from the predations of Solomon. That's the sense of this poetry before us today. In the epilogue, there is an increasing, and sense this, get a sense for this. There is an increasing sense of victory and vindication in the epilogue. This is her triumph, Shulamith's triumph. An increasing sense of victory and vindication in the epilogue as wisdom begins to permeate even the domain of Solomon, right? This happens with biblical wisdom. Wherever it is nurtured, wherever it occurs, it eventually triumphs. That's why we can be optimistic in our culture because we can triumph as well with biblical wisdom. We don't have to gaze at our navels, twiddle our thumbs and say, oh no, what's happening to the world? No, we have biblical wisdom we bring to the world. And it will turn some of those in that rock and roll culture. It will turn some of those leading the harem life contemporized in our own day and time today. It will transform. So get that sense of increasing victory and vindication for Shulamith. And she affirms this in her conclusion, which builds upon resolve of her sisters in the harem. I was a wall, double entendre there too. I was a young virgin girl at one time, but I was also protected, right? In her mother's chamber, right? The idea of being in her mother's house, listening to her mother's teaching. We saw that last week, right? She was protected. I was a wall, double entendre, deliberate. And my breasts were like towers. That's not a contradiction, right? My breasts were like towers. That is, I reached the full flower of my womanhood, my beauty. So, and once again, Hebrew poetry we have here, four words, four Hebrew words. She has summarized her successful probation with a nice pun. She was strong in resisting the temptations of the Elvis of Israel and his rock and roll culture. And she was a full-grown beauty now, ready for covenant marriage. My breasts were like towers. She's ready now for marriage. And then, nicely put by the ESV, then I was in his eyes. Emphasis on the then. That is, after her probation, after her time of testing, in the harem, when Solomon thought that he had her on his probation. No, you were on God's probation, as was she. And she passed, and you failed. Solomon, you were the Nabal. You were the fool. She was the wise. Then I was in his eyes. That is, after passing probation. Then I was in his eyes, my beloved. That is, the shepherd boy. And then I was in his eyes, my beloved, as one who finds peace. One who finds peace. We're talking about true shalom here. Hebrew word is shalom. And once again, when you study the Hebrew notion of peace, the biblical notion of true shalom, peace, it's not just an absence of war and strife. In our culture, our understanding, oftentimes peace is just, oh, just, you know, stop the war, okay? Let's have peace in the Middle East, right? Stop shooting each other and rioting and all that stuff. Let's have peace in the American cities, right? It generally just means a surcease from war and strife. No, the idea of biblical shalom is the fullness of life. The fullness of life with health and prosperity. And most importantly, a right relationship with God and man. Wisdom literature, as Brian is fond of pointing out to us, wisdom literature teaches us how to have a right relationship with God and man, and therefore have true shalom. There's yet another pun on the names here, too. The idea of shalom, peace. Shalom with Solomon and Shulamith. Some of the same consonants again, meant to rhyme, meant to pun, if you will. The idea of true peace is with Shulamith, not Solomon. This young farm beauty, we saw in the opening chapters of the song that she had this primitive beauty that could be seen and could be cultivated, right? She was tan. Well, that they could take care of that with creams and, you know, a year in the shade, and her skin would be pearly white again, and she'd be ready for Solomon, right? That was the understanding, and she was shy about that to begin with, but she was a young farm beauty. She has displayed godly wisdom. And by displaying godly wisdom, as we see time and time again throughout the wisdom literature, throughout Proverbs especially. When you find wisdom, seek wisdom, you also find shalom. You find peace in that full biblical sense of the word. She has found it now. Proverbs 3:17 tells us that in the finding of wisdom, her ways, that is wisdom's ways, are ways of pleasantness, and all her paths are peace. The paths of wisdom are peace. Shalom. As we've been maintaining, Song of Solomon is not just a random collection of erotic poems, as some characterize it. Song of Solomon is not a dialogue between Shulamith and Solomon, you know, where Solomon is saying, all right, I got 700 wives and 300 concubines, but I really love you. Right? That's the upshot of many an interpretation of the Song of Solomon. And the Song of Solomon is not allegory either. That is speaking of Christ and the church in a direct way. The Song of Solomon gives no literary evidences of being allegory. Song of Solomon is at its heart a true affirmation of biblical covenant marriage. And if Shulamith were to hear Paul's words proleptically, that the one man, one woman marital bond speaks of Christ in the church, that indeed, as Paul says, this mystery is profound. And I'm saying that it refers to Christ and the church. Shulamith would shake her head in assent and give a hearty amen. She would know exactly what Paul is talking about. That's where Christ is in the text. You don't have to go thrashing and cutting and throwing and making stuff up in order to find Christ in the text, because he's there in this sense. And Shulamith would be faithful to Christ too. She would know him and be faithful to him. There is a correspondence in covenantal faithfulness. There is a correspondence in covenantal faithfulness. That's why covenant is so important to understand. If you take covenant seriously, and you are faithful to all of your covenants, you will be faithful to your marital covenant, you will be faithful to your covenant with Christ. There is a correspondence in unfaithfulness as well. If you are unfaithful in your covenant to your spouse, more than likely you will be unfaithful in your covenant with Christ as well. They go hand in hand. It happened with Solomon, unfaithful to his marital covenant. He descended into idolatry. Many who take up idolatry descend into sexual immorality as well, right? There was a correspondence in covenantal faithfulness, and there was a correspondence in covenantal unfaithfulness. Shulamith knows Christ. She goes on to affirm that victory and that vindication as well in comparing and contrasting the respective vineyards of Hochmah, the wise, and Nabal, the fool. All right, the vineyards, the respective vineyards. Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Haman. He let out the vineyard to keepers, right? Or she has a vineyard too, my very own, she says. Well, this vineyard of Nabal, the fool, Solomon's the author. Solomon does not come off well, does he? Solomon does not come off well in the Song of Solomon. It takes a bit of humility to admit that you were wrong, right? And the vineyard of Nabal, the fool, Solomon, at Baal Haman, it's not a place, but a state. Commentators have long thrashed through Israel looking for Baal Haman. Well, it's not a place. It's rather a state. It means father of abundance, Baal Haman. And that's Solomon. Solomon in his state of glory and luxury. This is his vineyard. The vineyard has been a consistent metaphor throughout the Song of Solomon as well. The vineyard has been a consistent metaphor for a woman's body and person. And for the fool here, for Solomon, it is his harem. That's his vineyard. Kept and maintained and flourished at great expense. Much of it showered on the virgin. For its fruit, 1,000 pieces of silver. Right? But for Shulamith, the voice of Chokmah, the voice of wisdom, what is it? She says, once again, just beautiful Hebrew poetry. Right? I have my vineyard. My vineyard is before me. I have my own vineyard. Father may have, mother may have, but God bless the child that has its own, right? That's got its own. Remember that spiritual? God bless the child that's got its own. She has her own. She has her very own. That is, she has her body and soul kept in its integrity. She has her very own vineyard. That is, her body and soul kept in its integrity, now given in covenant marriage to her beloved. Do you see the victory and the vindication in the epilogue? And she has the well-earned temerity to address Solomon directly. You, O Solomon, you can have your numberless virgins. I have my one beloved, and he has me. My vineyard is before me. Behold, true shalom, true peace in the vineyard of Shulamith. But she's not done. She gives a kind of altar call to those who seek the voice of wisdom too. That brings us to verses 13 and 14. We're in the epilogue. Shulamith's Solomonic wisdom is confident and generous enough so as to offer an invitation to the harem and the beloved to join her. Verses 13 and 14. O you who dwell in the gardens, with companions listening for your voice, let me hear it. Make haste, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountains of spices, inviting her beloved to her. Let's get married. Short engagement period, right? Well, there's an intentionally ambiguous voice here. O you who dwell in the gardens. Intentionally ambiguous. Is it the voice of wisdom? Is it the voice of the shepherd boy or Shulamith or even Solomon? Intentionally ambiguous. Meant to be a voice of wisdom for wisdom. And it calls to those who dwell in the gardens. That is, those who are ripe, those who are awakened, are ready for love, i.e. for covenantal marriage. And their companions, their soon-to-be's, if you will. And calls to them the voice of wisdom to lift up their voices and ask for wisdom. Let me hear it, wisdom says. James puts it this way. He says, if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given him. Wisdom is calling out to hear the voices of those who seek Chokmah, not Nebah, foolishness. And there are many who stand at the same crossroads today. Many have stood at these crossroads throughout history. They have in every generation. Every generation could read the Song of Solomon and get the same wisdom. And today, many young women have only the voices of women like the feminist Kate Millett, don't they? Many young women in our culture today have only the voices of women like the feminist Kate Millett or the rock and roll voices of Madonna or Lady Gaga or whoever's the current hit, right? But all of them are voices of the harem. That is anything that wanders from the biblical covenantal model of one man and one woman and will descend inevitably into sexual immorality and idolatry. We have in the life of Shulamith a truly wise woman, as wise as Ruth, as wise as the woman of wisdom in Proverbs that we read in our Old Testament lesson today. We have in her the voice of wisdom. One man, one woman, covenantal marriage. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and his mother and be united to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. One flesh relationship. The daughters of New Geneva, daughters of America, oh, and those daughters of Jerusalem, or if we contemporize it, the daughters of Hollywood, we might say, right? Hearken to the voice of Shulamith, to the voice of wisdom, and resist the siren song of Solomon. It's still out there. That's step one, but you can't replace something with nothing either. Embrace, study, cherish the biblical model of love that is rock solid, white hot, endures trials, and brings true shalom to peace. And always know that it is inseparable, too, from the mystery of Christ and the church. Faithfulness to covenant is faithfulness to Christ. You can't be faithful to Christ and be unfaithful in your marital relationship or any other covenant that you've cut. I have a covenant with my brothers in the OPC. If I violate that covenant, most likely I'm violating other covenants as well. One is often an index of the other. Faithfulness in one covenant is indicative of faithfulness in the other, and vice versa. Shulamith would perceive this intuitively in her wisdom. She has. And the shalom that she has achieved speaks of that shalom that we will know as well when our bridegroom returns. Shulamith bids her beloved to come. Make haste, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountain of spices. That is, get here quick, okay? Get here quickly. Come fast. Shulamith bids her beloved to come to her, even as we bid our bridegroom, the Lord Jesus Christ, to come as well. Come, Lord Jesus. Even so, come. Right? Well, let us now then come to that place where we hear the voice of our bridegroom as he speaks in his body and blood in the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.